live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Coming up on today's show, an ICE facility that the town supervisor of New Windsor knew nothing about. ICE is quietly expanding its footprint in the Hudson Valley. We'll have the details from Kimberly Izar. Also, PFAS, those forever chemicals? Well, the Senate in New York has passed two bills. They're taking action, and we'll talk about what these bills would do and what's still at stake. As climate change pushes sea levels higher in New York, officials are turning to new technology to track and plan for the threat of flooding. Plus, the latest news from the Greater Homesdale Partnership. And Sudie Sullivan invites audiences to the ball this Valentine's Day with a family-friendly screening of the Met Opera's Cinderella. The news is next.
Coleman. President Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, says the federal immigration surge in Minnesota is going to come to an end.
With that, and success that has been made arresting public safety threats and other priorities since this surge operation began, as well as the unprecedented levels of coordination we have obtained from state officials and local law enforcement, I have proposed, and President Trump has concurred, that this surge operation conclude.
Homan says a significant drawdown of federal officers is already underway this week in Minnesota and will continue next week. But he says immigration enforcement will continue in the state. The action comes after federal agents shot and killed two protesters in Minneapolis last month. Meanwhile, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is expected to hold a press conference later this hour. The Department of Homeland Security could partially shut down late tomorrow unless Congress passes a spending bill for the agency. This morning, three top officials who oversee immigration operations are testifying before a Senate committee. The House has passed a Republican effort to create more requirements for voting and for registering to vote in federal elections. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports the measure faces tough odds in the Senate.
The bill is known as the, quote, Save America Act, and it's the second major effort by House Republicans since last year to require U.S. citizens to show their birth or naturalization certificate, passport, or another document proving their citizenship when registering to vote in federal elections. The bill would also require showing a photo ID when casting a ballot. Supporters of the bill say they're trying to prevent illegal voting by non-U.S. citizens, which is incredibly rare. But voting rights groups are concerned that the bill, if enacted, would make it harder for many eligible voters to vote. Survey suggests 1 in 10 adult U.S. citizens do not have their citizenship documents or cannot quickly find one to show the next day. While the bill has passed the House, it's not clear there are enough votes for it to pass in the Senate. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as the National Association of Realtors reports a drop in home sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 260 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes slumped in January. Sales dropped more than 8% from December and were down more than 4% from January of last year. The average sales price last month was just under $397,000. That's up less than 1% from a year ago. The realtors say falling interest rates have made home buying a little more affordable over the last year. McDonald's stock opened higher after the fast food chain reported better-than-expected sales and profits for the most recent quarter. Sales in the U.S. jumped nearly 7%, thanks in part to discounts aimed at cost-conscious diners and a Christmas-themed Grinch meal. New applications for unemployment benefits were slightly lower last week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow's now up 250 points. This is NPR. A new survey finds that President Trump's support among white Christians is declining, but most still support him. Bob Smetana of Religion News Service prepared this report.
White Christians played a key role in both President Trump's elections, but a new survey by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center found their support is waning. Trump's approval rating among white Christians dropped to 57% from 66%. That includes a loss in support among white evangelicals, usually his most ardent backers. More than half of white evangelicals still support President Trump's policies, but just 40% are confident that he behaves ethically as president, according to the survey. Still, white Christians support Trump more than any other Americans. For NPR News, I'm Bob Smetana.
The International Olympic Committee has disqualified an athlete from Ukraine. He was to compete in the skeleton sliding race. Vladislav Haraskevich had wanted to wear a helmet with the faces of Ukrainians killed by Russia's attacks in Ukraine. NPR's Brian Mann reports he'd refused the IOC's suggestion that he wear a black armband instead.
The IOC said it amounted to political expression, banning rules designed to make the Olympics neutral. The decision, the IOC said in a statement, followed his refusal to comply with the IOC's guidelines on athlete expression. Posting on Instagram after he was banned from competition, Hariskevich said, "This is the price of our dignity."
NPR's Brian Mann reporting from Italy. I'm Korva Kuhlman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. We're starting off with news about an ICE office that's been quietly operating in Orange County for months. ICE has quietly expanded its presence in the Mid-Hudson Valley, opening an office in New Windsor, a move the town's supervisor says he knew nothing about. The news comes as thousands of people have pushed back against a proposed ICE warehouse in Chester at a former Pep Boys warehouse. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar reports.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has expanded its footprint in the Mid-Hudson Valley. New reporting from Wired reveals that ICE has an existing office in New Windsor in Orange County, part of ICE's broader plans to expand to more than 150 new offices across the country. Town of New Windsor Supervisor Stephen Bedetti says he had no idea that there was any ICE presence in the town.
So I was not aware of it, didn't know it was there, had no clue. So, which I guess in the end of this conversation is not a bad thing. When I say it's not a bad thing that I didn't know nothing about it. It means it's been quiet there, right?
Bedetti confirmed that 843 Union Avenue in New Windsor has been used by ICE as office space for more than 4 months. Bedetti says he spoke with Martin Reisman. He's the property owner who says that the building has a contract with the General Services Administration, the agency which helps secure and manage office leases for the federal government. Bedetti says he visited the building on Tuesday night and it was rather quiet. He saw mostly cubicles, vacant office space, and excessive surveillance.
I will tell you there's an inordinate amount of cameras on the outside and inside of the building, too.
The New Windsor office is just 2 miles from the Stewart International Airport and 30 minutes from a proposed ICE facility in Chester. Thousands of people have opposed the facility, including Congressmember Pat Ryan, Orange County Executive Stephen Newhouse, and Supervisor Bedetti.
I'm not in favor of that facility there and that going there in the middle of somebody's town, and I want them to support me if it happens here. You know, I got the airport right in my town, right? They brought presidents from other countries here in handcuffs. So I'm, concerned that, they might want to try to land here in New Windsor. And if they do, then, I'm going to have my say in that as well.
While ICE is allowed to rent office space in New Windsor, Bedetti says he'll be keeping an eye on any potential other activities, like the building being used as a detention space.
But, listen, I'm not stupid. At the end of the day, are these folks going to call me up and tell me? I didn't even know they were there. So they're certainly not going to call me and tell me if they use it for a different use, right? I told them, both of them, the council and the property owner, that I'm going to keep an eye on the place, and I'm asking people to call me that are inside the building other than those, the different tenants. If they see something off, give me a call.
Wired's reporting shows that ICE is moving into two other offices within an hour and a half from the Hudson Valley in Roseland, New Jersey, and Woodbury, New York, in Long Island. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And Congressmember Pat Ryan said on Wednesday that ICE's increased presence in New Windsor was done without any local or federal cooperation. He's demanded more information from ICE and the Department of Homeland Security about the purpose of the office spaces. Ryan is demanding a response from the federal government by February 20th. Now, turning to PFAS, those forever chemicals, the class of more than 10,000 synthetic compounds designed to resist heat, water, grease, and stains. We see them in products we use every day, like nonstick cookware, waterproof clothing, cosmetics, food packaging, and even carpets and furniture. The problem is they don't break down, not even in the environment and not in our bodies. Over time, PFAS accumulate in soil, waterways, drinking water supplies, and human bloodstreams. Studies have linked exposure to increased risk of certain cancers, developmental effects in children, immune system suppression, and reproductive harm. This week in Albany, lawmakers advanced two bills aimed at limiting PFAS exposure, including a measure requiring a greater disclosure of PFAS discharges into waterways, and another that would ban the chemicals in many consumer and household products. Several other related bills are still awaiting action in the Assembly. Joining us now to talk about what this legislation would do and why advocates say the moment is urgent is Kate Donovan, Director of Northeast Environmental Health at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Kate, welcome.
Hi, Tim. Thank you.
These two bills, the PFAS Discharge Disclosure Act and the ban on PFAS in consumer and household products, have now passed the Senate in Albany. What would these measures actually do?
Yeah, so you're right. They both passed the Senate this week, which was great news. So we're waiting on the Assembly to take up these two, in addition to other ones you mentioned. Addressing the PFAS contamination crisis in New York requires multiple policies, right? There's not just one single piece of legislation that's going to solve the problem. We need to look upstream to kind of like turn off the tap to PFAS. And that's what the PFAS and Consumer Products Bill does. It says, we don't need to use PFAS in these particular consumer products because they're unnecessary. There are alternatives on the market and they're contributing to kind of the influx of PFAS into our system. And we also have to address the downstream impacts of PFAS, and we actually have to understand where it's coming from. There are thousands of manufacturing and industrial facilities across New York that use these chemicals in industrial processes as lubricants, as additives for cleaning machinery. We just don't know exactly where it's all coming from. And the PFAS Disclosure Act would help us understand that.
And it focuses on transparency. Why is that disclosure such an important first step?
Because then we know where to regulate it, right? So we, you know, lots of different facilities that if they're making, I don't know, say paper or textiles or electroplating, all these different industries, like I said, use these chemicals in the processes, and we don't know exactly how to permit them because we don't know who's discharging them.
And the consumer products ban, the other bill, goes upstream, targeting PFAS before they enter the waste stream. Some advocates have described this whole thing as a life cycle problem from production to disposal. How do these two bills, you know, help fit into that broader strategy of limiting that life cycle problem?
Yeah, exactly. So as I mentioned, and you said upstream, so we know that these chemicals are being intentionally added to products that we use in our homes. Not to mention, of course, the exposure to the products and the use in our homes is a concern, of course. But ultimately, when these products get washed down the drain, such as cleaning products, paint, personal care, cosmetic products, they end up in our wastewater stream. Those chemicals then travel downstream into our wastewater treatment plants that are therefore filtering some of it, but not all of it. And then it's being discharged into surface waters, or the other way products end up into the water is they end up in landfills. You know, those Teflon pans, as soon as they scratch, right, you throw them in the trash, or at least that's what you're supposed to do, as we've been told. And those pans and all of those other products end up in landfills, incinerators, and then are burned. The chemicals from those are ending up in landfill leachate or being emitted into air emissions.
Passing the Senate is a big win, a big step. It still has to pass the Assembly. Several supporters have pointed to potential federal rollbacks of PFAS protections. How does that shape what's happening in Albany this session? Do you think that's causing lawmakers to act with more urgency?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, nothing is positive coming out of the federal government right now. It's certainly in relation to environmental issues and in PFAS, there's certainly risk. One of the other bills that's on our kind of package, our slate, would to actually adopt the federal maximum contaminant levels for a couple of PFAS chemicals. So under the previous administration, they actually set the most protective science-based levels for PFAS stronger than New York State's levels. That, of course, is being rolled back at the federal level. And there is a piece of legislation that we're supporting that would require New York to, what we would say, codify those federal levels into state law. And so that's a direct piece of legislation to combat what's happening at the federal level.
If New York doesn't codify or strengthen its own standards, what are the risks?
Well, it just means New York still is protective. We have levels at 10 parts per trillion. So that's the maximum allowed level of POFA and POFS that can be allowed in New York State municipal drinking water. Of course, that's only two chemicals, right? And you mentioned there's over 10,000. So that would leave several smaller systems in New York kind of under that 10 parts per trillion threshold, which would still be at risk.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Kate Donovan, Director of Northeast Environmental Health at NRDC, about several PFAS-related bills in Albany. Two passed the Senate this week. There are still several others awaiting action. I want to talk about some of those other bills that are still pending. You mentioned one of them, including the Beauty Justice Act. Talk about what that one would do and how that would change things.
Yeah, this is a great piece of legislation. This kind of goes hand in hand with the consumer products bill. So we know that personal care and cosmetics have all sorts of nasty things in them, including PFAS, right? We know that PFAS is used in waterproof mascaras, in different types of lotions and conditioners to make things kind of feel slick and straighter. And in addition to PFAS, there's, you know, heavy metals, asbestos, all sorts of, you know, hormone disruptors and allergic additives. So the Beauty Justice Bill would phase out and ban the most toxic chemicals out of these consumer personal care and cosmetics, as well as PFAS. And we also know that these particular products with these high levels of toxicity are marketed to disproportionately to brown and black communities. That's why we think it's a very important environmental justice piece of legislation, because these communities are at risk of having products with the higher levels of contaminants.
Another bill awaiting approval is the moratorium on spreading sewage sludge on farmland. Issue might surprise some people. How does farmland become part of the PFAS story?
Yeah, this is a very interesting one. So as I mentioned, you put products down the drains, right? In your sink, in your home, could be paint, could be cosmetics, could be personal care, pharmaceuticals, right? All of those, that mix of stuff, toxics, ends up in our wastewater treatment systems. Those treatment systems separate, quote unquote, solid, our waste, and the liquid part of it then gets kind of treated and then moved on to a drinking water or some other kind of other pathway. But the solid, the sludge, if you will, is highly concentrated in all of those other chemicals that came down the drain. And that sludge at one point in time, many, many years ago, people, what are we going to do with this sludge? It was often incinerated or landfilled. But then there was this brilliant idea that it has a lot of nutrients in it. I mean, theoretically, without all of the toxics, that type of biomass can be used as a fertilizer. And so over time, a practice started to happen across the United States, in New York as well, of that sewage sludge being sold to farmland. So here in New York, oftentimes that sludge that is remaining from wastewater treatment facilities gets sold to farmers, and it is spread on our farmland across the state. Unfortunately, it's highly concentrated with PFAS chemicals and other toxicants. So it's a big concern. It gets spread onto our land, and we know from testing that our food supply is at great risk of uptaking all sorts of things that are contained in that sewage sludge.
Yeah. There's also a bill to codify federal PFAS drinking water standards into state law. What's that about, and why is that necessary now?
Yep, and that was the one I was referring to before. This is a real direct response to what's happening at the federal level, right? To say that we want the strongest levels possible. And under the Biden administration, they set those levels. We know that the Trump administration is rolling them back. And so we're saying to New York, look, you already were expected to meet these standards, you know, just less than a year ago or a year ago. So you need to move forward with keeping with those standards and not go backwards, even if they're not going to be required at the federal level.
Got it. Let's take a quick break, Kate. And when we come back, I want to ask you a little bit more about the human impact and then what the next steps are. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with more from Kate Donovan, Director of Northeast Environmental Health at NRDC. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
African American history as told by the people who were there. Like an unsung pioneer in heart surgery whose procedure saved millions of lives.
Vivian Thomas is teaching white surgeons, and by night, he is a servant to those same people.
I'm Ben Henderson. Join me for Witness History, U.S. Black History Month from the BBC World Service.
Monday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're resuming our conversation with Kate Donovan at NRDC about PFAS and the action that New York lawmakers are taking. Two bills passed the state Senate. They still have to pass the assembly. We're talking about some of the other bills pending and also just the overall human impact that PFAS have. Kate, we've talked before about that, but we've also heard from residents of places like Newburgh who've lived with contaminated water and other issues, other health issues. How do these community stories shape the push for this regulation?
I mean, the community members are really why we're doing this work. They have been poisoned for a lifetime, especially when you're talking about the residents of Hoosick Falls and Newburgh, as you mentioned, Petersburg. There are many, many across the state, and they will live with levels of PFAS in their blood. And we all, you know, likely we all have levels, but elevated levels for them in particular. And I've heard some community members talk about living with a kind of a ticking time bomb in their bodies of what particular illness they may develop over a period of time. We know PFAS and are linked to many serious health effects and also other effects like, you know, high cholesterol or reduced impact from the uptake of a vaccine. We also know that PFAS is transmitted through breast milk. We are finding it in placentas and umbilical cords. It really is pervasive in the human body. And we did a study recently, NRDC and another organization, to kind of understand what the health costs are. If it's not bad enough to know what the health impacts are, you know, sometimes when you talk about the cost to the state, that helps legislators understand what we need to do. And we conservatively estimated it ranged between $2.7 and $4.4 billion annually in expected healthcare costs from PFAS contamination in these communities.
You know, we're talking about how PFAS are everywhere. I'm thinking back to last night. I made salmon in nonstick cookware. So it's in my house. It's likely in everybody's homes. Is it likely that it's in drinking water as well? I mean, when you come to like consumer products and then you talk about like water supply, are there differences of the levels of contamination that are seen?
Yeah. So the main pathway to PFAS contamination and ingesting it is through water consumption. And like everything, it all flows downhill, right? So when we talk about the upstream in the products, ultimately our water supplies, our drinking water supplies are being contaminated by its kind of use, disposal. And we know, because New York State has been addressing the water issues for many years now, we know roughly where this contamination is. And that's why communities like Hoosick Falls and Newburgh, we know particularly that their drinking water supplies were contaminated and that residents in those locations in particular were drinking highly contaminated water for a longer period of time. You can check on your own municipal, you know, website if you can find out what the levels of PFAS are in your communities. That's available on Department of Health's website. So there is a little bit of transparency now, but just remember, those are just two chemicals, the POFA and POFS. There are thousands more that are likely, you know, invading our water supply that we just don't know about.
And let's talk about what's next in the process. If this full legislative package passes, how quickly would New Yorkers begin to see change?
Yeah, I mean, so we're hopeful that we'll get our package this year. A number of these bills depends on the implementation period. So some of the consumer products bills, they give industry a, you know, a year or two before it is actually implemented to allow you know, producers and retailers to adjust the new law. Something like the moratorium on the application of sewage sludge, that would take effect immediately. So in terms of when they actually become implemented is different for each one, but we know that these policies are happening, you know, these packages of legislation are happening all across the United States in many different states. So it is a movement that the states are taking control of regulating PFAS. And New York has, you know, in previous years been a leader. We do have some protective laws in New York on PFAS, but they need to do more. And so we're hoping that this year is the year for them to, you know, for the legislature to step up again and pass some really significant reforms on PFAS regulation.
What happens next in Albany? And what are advocates, what are you guys watching for in the coming weeks?
Yeah, so of course, you know, Albany is really consumed by the state budget at the moment.
Yeah.
so we are, you know, we had a fantastic lobby day yesterday talking to over, you know, 30 members about this package of PFAS bills. There was a really great reception. Like we mentioned, it was nice to see the Senate passing some of these early in session, which is great. So we'll continue our drumbeat. We'll continue talking to legislators. We'll continue talking about this issue. We hope that by Earth Day in April, there will be another big push by the environmental community to pass whatever legislation hasn't been passed by then, and hoping that the remainder of these bills will get across the line.
The advocates have said that New York missed a chance last session. What do you think makes this moment different?
Obviously, things being rolled back at the federal level, there's a lot more certainty that those things aren't going to happen at the federal level. So it gives New York an opportunity to stand up to the federal government in the environmental space on these bills. And, you know, we just think that the time is right to really address this. We have new sources of PFAS kind of coming online in terms of other industries, right? And we need to really start tackling the issue. And I think legislators understand that. And every day, it seems, there's a new study coming out about what we know. We know enough to act.
That's Kate Donovan, Director of Northeast Environmental Health for NRDC. More information at nrdc.org. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, sea levels in New York have risen 9 inches since 1950, and they're still climbing. A new tool aims to help communities understand what that means for their flood risk. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org, and from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. We bring you a taste of the newest season of the Futuro Studios hit show, La Brega.
You couldn't, in good faith, stand back and look up at that pedestal and say, Juan Ponce de Leon is standing tall and proud and straight, you know?
That's this week on Latino USA. today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sea levels have risen 9 inches in New York since 1950 and continue rising an inch every 7 to 8 years. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Ilias Guerra reports on how a new tool can help upstate communities track their risk of flooding.
Even in balmy weather, Kingston is susceptible to flooding. Julie Noble, project manager for the city and lifelong Kingston resident, says the city is already experiencing a type of flooding called sunny day flooding, which is caused by high ocean tides that push up the Hudson River.
A couple areas along our Rondo Creek waterfront and a couple of areas along our Hudson River waterfront that we normally now keep road barricades located right by the side of the road that have a big sign that says road floods regularly and or flooded road closed.
A USGS water level monitor on the Rondout Creek shows the river height spiked from its usual spring height up 5 feet on May 10th, 2025 before 2 a.m. while much of the Hudson Valley was in a flood warning. As part of Kingston flood mitigation efforts, a new tool can help. Riverkeeper, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the Hudson River, has developed a resource that includes a map of the Hudson and is filled with data. Science director at Riverkeeper, Shannon Roback, says communities can use the tool to learn how global warming will affect their area in the Hudson Valley.
Will 3 feet of sea level rise look like? What will 6 feet and 10 feet of sea level rise look like?
The tool also shows if big and small waterways are safe for swimming, fishing, drinking, and if DEC has tested the water quality and said it's safe. The tool's climate change layer offers predictions for sea level rise on the Hudson River. Some areas that are already at risk include Piermont, Tarrytown, Stony Point, Peekskill, Kingston, and Albany. As Noble mentioned, Kingston is already thinking a lot about sea level rise. Noble says between FEMA dollars and other sources, Kingston is investing about $45 million into projects like converting a parking lot that remains permanently flooded into a wetland.
It's already growing on its own, and so we're letting it establish on its own and letting the natural vegetation make its way there on its own.
Another project was to protect the wastewater treatment plant from flooding. Upgrades included adding floodgates at the doors and elevating critical infrastructure 11 feet off the ground, which Noble says has effectively stopped the risk of flooding. Noble says that as part of the advisory committee of the Hudson Valley Flood Resilience Network, she sees what different communities in the Hudson Valley are doing to prepare. The Riverkeeper's tool will be especially helpful to Hudson Valley communities that lack their own resources to plan for future floods. Like Kingston, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which has tracks going up and down the Hudson Valley, is working full steam ahead on flood mitigation plans.
Really, we want to make sure that as climate change occurs, we can continue service on the Hudson line, you know, for the next 100 years. And in order to do that, we have to prevent, you know, slope failures, culvert washouts, sea level rise and tidal flooding encroachment and all these, you know, sort of risks that are going to be magnified by climate change.
That's Eric Wilson, Senior Vice President for Climate and Land Use Planning at MTA Construction and Development. Wilson says the MTA is regularly planning for sea level rise and other extreme weather events like flash floods and heavy rainfall.
We're experiencing the impacts of torrential rain right now as we are sea level rise. But in terms of magnitude of consequence, it's truly the flash floods, the intense rains that are most consequential.
That doesn't mean that sea level rise is not impacting the Metro North lines.
Well, in our 25 to 29 capital plan, we did reserve $800 million just for the Hudson line.
Because it runs along the Hudson River, Metro North's Hudson line is one of the MTA's most vulnerable train lines. The MTA says it is making investments to help. These include modernizing aging infrastructure and installing barriers that can prevent landslides or flash floods, as well as elevating the most low-lying areas of the Hudson line, like the Garrison Station.
A lot of our existing culvert infrastructure was built nearly 100 years ago for a different climate, also for a different time when the upland was not as developed.
That's Alda Chan, Director of Climate Resilience Planning, who manages Metro North projects. Chan and Wilson said in the MTA's $68 billion 2025 to 2029 capital plan, every investment takes climate change into account. Shannon Roback says that while sea level rise is gradual, it's really storms that show how bad it can get.
That degree of flooding will worsen as the base level sea level rise gets higher.
Noble says communities need to start thinking and investing to deal with sea level rise and other extreme weather. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
Quick break for us, and when we come back, what's happening in Honesdale this weekend and beyond? We check in with the Greater Honesdale Partnership. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, there's lots going on in the area, particularly in Honesdale. So we're going to check in with Sarah Miller, events coordinator for the Greater Honesdale Partnership. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You've got a ton of things happening in Honesdale. I want to get to all that, but tell us a little bit more about the Greater Honesdale Partnership and your role there as events coordinator.
So the Greater Honesdale Partnership is a nonprofit organization. We're often confused with the borough. We are not the borough. We are a nonprofit, and we're dedicated to supporting and working very closely with the borough for our local businesses and strengthening Honesdale as a community. We focus on economic development, revitalization, and creating opportunities that bring people into our downtown and support our amazing businesses that we have here.
How do you guys go about that to support those businesses and contribute to the Honesdale community?
So as the events coordinator, I work very closely with my executive director, Sandy, and we create local events, whether they are historic events like our July sidewalk sales or promotional events throughout the year, and just supporting other local organizations that are bringing people in and supporting local businesses.
How do you keep it up year round? I mean, you know, sometimes it's a little seasonal in the region because of the weather when it comes to tourism and shopping and, you know, folks being local. How do you keep that up year round? What events or initiatives does the partnership organize to encourage community engagement and local shopping to support businesses?
So I'm very fortunate in my position that I have a lot of local businesses and nonprofits that are just as passionate as we are about keeping our local community thriving and driving foot traffic into our town. So like for Valentine's Day this weekend, I think almost every store and business and restaurant has something happening in town. So they definitely make it easier. It's just a matter of promoting it and getting people out there to realize that we have everything those big box stores have on a much more local level.
And it's not only Valentine's, it's a three-day weekend, so more likely to have more people in town as well. And
yes.
And one of the ways that you also help keep things year-round is you say, hey, weather, we're going to ignore you. Take some of the stuff inside. Talk about your indoor sidewalk sales that are coming up.
Yeah, so thankfully, this is the second year we're promoting it. We just want people to realize it's a way for our local businesses to get some of those things cleared out for to make way for our all of the spring inventory that needs to come in. It also helps give those much needed sales and discounts to people to get them out there shopping. We definitely want to stay warm this winter. It's definitely been brutal.
Yeah, it is tough out there. How are folks feeling though in the community about business so far this winter?
I think it's been very upbeat. I think we're not letting that snow stop us, the cold stop us. It's definitely been some work there for us.
And if there are folks that are not involved with you, businesses, how can they get connected?
You can get connected by visiting our website, visit honesdalepa.com. We also post regularly on Facebook and Instagram. That's a great way to keep up to date in real time with things that are happening in our community.
And you've got, as you mentioned, the events coming up this weekend for the Valentine's Day weekend, your indoor sidewalk sales. Anything else coming up you want folks to know about?
We are in full swing of planning all of our year's events. So Girls Night Out is definitely coming together. That's another great promotional event. You know, over 600 ladies last year participated in May. So May 7th, just keep that on your radar. We are in full swing of planning our fireworks celebration. There's a lot of really great things coming our way for this year.
And before we go, I just wanted to ask more about the Honesdale Dollars program. What is that and how does that support local businesses?
Oh, the Honesdale Dollars program is, so we have gotten sponsorships and they're $5 tokens. You can either purchase them from us, or we've distributed over $1,200 worth of them throughout downtown during last year's sidewalk sales. And it's the same as cash. So you can walk into any participating business with your token and use it, and they give you the $5 discount. And then in turn, the businesses then in turn turn it back to us, and we give them back that
$5. All right.
So it's just another way for us to promote people downtown shopping.
Sarah Miller, Events Coordinator at the Greater Honesdale Partnership. Keep it busy. Thank you so much for joining us and letting us know what's going on over there in the borough.
All right. Thank you so much.
There's more information at visithonesdalepa.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, if you're looking for something magical this Valentine's Day, Suni Sullivan is presenting the Met's production of Cinderella. We'll find out more after this with Classical Kit. It's Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, writer Jhumpa Lahiri. She's the author of Interpreter of Maladies and The Namesake. Lahiri now lives mostly in Italy. And for her latest book, Whereabouts, she first wrote the story in Italian before translating it into English. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week we have food and feelings with Jarell Guy's new cookbook that helps us take care of ourselves when we need a boost. Also, food writer Bea Wilson sheds light on the emotional lives of kitchen tools. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, this weekend, Suni Sullivan is presenting the Met Opera's enchanting production of Cinderella with music, romance, and a chance for kids to dress for the ball. Let's listen to a little bit of the overture to that as before we start our conversation.
And that sounds like the mice from the Disney version. I don't think there are any mice in the opera.
That, of course, is Classical Kit. For anything classical, we turn to Classical Kit for news and information about what's going on. That sounds beautiful. And we also have a special guest today. Right, Kit?
Yes. Deborah Cartwright is joining us.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Yeah, so, Deborah... You come to us actually from another opera company. You are on the board of Delaware Valley Opera, correct?
Correct, I am.
And you're going to be giving a pre-concert talk at this wonderful screening of Cinderella at SUNY Sullivan. You know, this opera, there aren't a whole lot of operas that really work well for kids, but this is one of them. A couple of years ago, SUNY Sullivan had the encore screening of The Magic Flute, which and it was an abridged version in English. And similar to that, this is going to be a short 90-minute version of Jules Massenet's opera and sung in English. And My understanding is that we really want a lot of kids to come to this, correct?
Absolutely. And the more the merrier, as well as it would be great to have them come in costume. There'll be a parade just prior to the showing of the film so that they can show off their costumes. I actually have some crowns and tiaras that they can decorate prior to the parade in case they are not in costume or if they want one. And I'm going to give some history and information about how Cinderella came to be.
Well, you know, it's such a beloved fairy tale, and it's been a ballet, it's been operas, it's, you know, it's been in many forms, but as something appealing to kids, the Met really sort of had that in mind. And I saw a video that was wonderful that after the 2 years of COVID, which was even longer for children not being able to go to the Met because there wasn't vaccines for children as early as there was for adults, they had a final dress rehearsal where they invited all the people that work at the Met, whether they were costume people or stagehands or singers or musicians, to bring their children to that performance. And I was really impressed about how much the kids loved it. Tim, do you have a little clip of some of the kids' reactions to that?
This is the kids returning to the Met for Cinderella, as Kit mentioned, on December 15th, 2021. They welcome back children to the Opera House for the final dress rehearsal of Mazinet's Cinderella. And let's take a little listen to some of that reaction.
My favorite part? I don't really have a favorite. All of the parts are my favorite.
It was awesome because it's my first time.
I've seen opera before, but this is my first time at the Met. It was a new experience because the last time I just watched it in a movie theater where they were streaming it.
At the very beginning, the very fancy chandeliers, they started to rise up.
It was just so perfect.
Yeah, so you can hear that children really responded very well to seeing this. And I'm really excited that SUNY Sullivan is going to create this opportunity for our local kids to experience that. Could you tell us a little bit about the opera, Deborah? Maybe a little hint of what you'll be talking about in your pre-concert talk?
Well, it tells the story, of course, of Cinderella. And I've done a lot of research, and it actually goes back to Greek.
Oh.
Prior to, the Greeks actually started the first story. It wasn't called Cinderella at that point. It was about a young girl who lived in the ashes, basically. And I also have collected books now from all the Cinderella versions throughout the world. And it is amazing to read through them and see how similar they all are to what ended up being the Cinderella that Massenet created.
Well, you know, it's kind of a classic rags to riches, but not the rags to riches of the young man who makes his way in the world, but more about a woman who, not a woman, really a girl, because she's very young, and the prince is actually very young also, who, just because of her station in life, is resigned to cleaning out the ashes in the fireplaces and scrubbing the floors, but because she's pure of heart, and as she sings, she has her soul. She's the one that the prince falls in love with. And one of the things that I noticed that's a little bit unusual is that in this opera, both the prince and Cinderella were written for women's voices.
And, correct.
Yeah, and definitely maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so typically the prince is played by a mezzo-soprano. In this case, it's Emily D'Angelo. And you have a mezzo-soprano, again, who is going to be Cinderella. And that role isn't necessarily always a mezzo, but the prince is. A couple of years ago, I was in Paris and saw Cendrillon in the Paris Opera House. And again, it was two women who were playing both roles. And it is typically done that way.
Yeah, well, my understanding is part of Massenet's thinking and doing it that way was he really wanted to convey their youth, that this is not about adults falling in love, and also to kind of capture the magical fairy tale dreamlike aspect of it. And I think, you know, that because children, male and female, have those higher voices, it does capture that kind of childlike wonder and, you know.
And magic, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. Versus, you know, like the Disney version that uses a female and then the male for the prince. It's a whole different level. And it's also a different type of romance that is created in that version. And even when you talk about Rodgers and Hammerstein's versions. But on Massenet's and on the opera stage, that became very popular to use a woman to fulfill male roles.
Right, and that was not uncommon in that romantic era. I think they called Correct. Them breeches parts.
Yeah. So
breeches being those short pants. You know, this is kind of a unique thing for SUNY Sullivan, and I know you're not with SUNY Sullivan, but this idea, I'm wondering if you know what the genesis was of this idea of making this Valentine's Day performance have these added elements of you giving the pre-concert talk, but also of inviting the children to come in costume.
Well, I think it's important that kids learn to love theater and musicals and opera. Delaware Valley Opera, we typically have done a children's production each year, and I bring the crafts and the activities for that, and we make sure that the production is something that the kids will understand and enjoy, along with parents who had never been to an opera before themselves. And this helps in the same scenario with this production of Cinderella, that it's important that it is something that the kids are going to understand and enjoy, and that there's a fun element to it besides just sitting there and watching Cinderella.
Great. Well, I want to give some of the details. So this will be this Saturday, Valentine's Day, February 14th. The doors will open at noon. You'll be giving your pre-opera talk at 12:15, and the costume parade will be at 12:45, so there will be a little bit of time there for kids to be ready. And then the screening of the opera begins at 1. It is a 90-minute performance, but I believe there will be an intermission. There usually is in these things.
Correct.
And it'll be at the Selig Theater at SUNY Sullivan, and tickets are available at sunysullivan.edu, but they can also be purchased at the door. And, you know, because we're hoping that children will come, there's a whole range of ticket prices to make it affordable with, you know, very low price for children under 5. So,
correct, for families to be able to participate.
Deborah, while we have you, Delaware Valley Opera just announced their auditions for upcoming productions. Do you want to let folks know what's coming up and when those auditions will be held, not only here, but also in New York City?
Yes. So the one in New York City is this coming Saturday, the 21st. Let me get you the name of the place.
I have it here. It's 528th Avenue
Correct.
And that's on your website as well, DelawareValleyOpera.org. But there's also an audition being held on February 28th here locally.
In the Arts Nest, correct, at 6692 Route 52 in Lake Huntington.
Yeah.
In the Arts Nest, in the smaller venue. It will be, it's from 12 to 2 o'clock.
And what are the productions you're having folks audition for?
It's for the Magic Flute, Mozart's Magic Flute, as well as Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado.
And if folks are interested, what do they need to prepare?
A brief bio, headshot, recent photo, resume. There's an audio clip that, if it's available, and the information would go to Carol Castell at ccastel3749@gmail.com.
And also, there's a lot. Yeah, go ahead.
They can bring their material with them if they don't have a chance to actually send it to her.
And also, there's a lot going on there at Delaware Valley Opera at the Arts Nest this weekend. River Rep Jr.'s Winter Workshop on the 14th, and a concert from Emily Barnes, Contemporary Folk, on the 15th, Sunday. Again, more information at DelawareValleyOpera.org, and more information at SUNYSullivan.edu for the special Valentine's screening of Massenet's Cinderella, plus the pre-opera talk and kids and family costume parade. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And are you going to dress in costume, Deborah?
Am I going to dress in costume?
I don't know, an idea. Think about it.
Well, I actually have part of it, so that's very possible.
All right. Surprises await.
And I do love dressing up.
Deborah, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for inviting me.
And Kit, there's so much going on. Just talked about the auditions that are coming up. We were talking about how winter seems to be a little quiet, but really in the classical scene, it really hasn't been.
Yeah, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
To speak with Andrew Trombley about an upcoming concert that the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra is putting on at two locations in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, lots going on.
The classical kids are not hibernating. Classical Kit, thank you so much. And we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that you can sign up for our weekly newsletter at our website. Just go to wjffradio.org. It's on the right-hand side in the yellow box. Sign up for the free newsletter. You'll stay connected and informed with all the latest local news, culture, and more delivered to your inbox every Friday. Sign up today. You'll get it tomorrow morning. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville, and at vintagehousejville.com, and from listeners like you.
This week, This Old House Radio Hour and Marketplace Morning Report present Building Tomorrow, a special episode exploring how homes are being reimagined for the next 100 years.
We destroy all these buildings, literally burn them down or throw a Category 3 hurricane at them so that we can figure out how to make them better.
That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
African American history as told by the people who were there, like an unsung pioneer in heart surgery whose procedure saved millions of lives.
Vivian Thomas is teaching white surgeons, and by night, he is a servant to those same people.
I'm Ben Henderson. Join me for Witness History, U.S. Black History Month from the BBC World Service.
Monday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, cloudy and breezy. You might see a passing flurry or two, no accumulation. high 27. The winds continue this evening, a low of 9. We're keeping an eye on a storm that may come close enough to bring some rain or snow later this weekend. Tomorrow, partly sunny, a high of 32, maybe up to an inch of snow later in the evening hours. For the weekend, 36 on Saturday with a couple of morning flurries. Sunday, 38 with, again, snow or flurries possible.
Donna Fellenberg here, and on Catskill Character this week, Mitch Guerrera, writer, performer, teacher, blogger, and creator, will share her Valentine's Day story and tell us how to make living the life of an expat in Italy work. So join us Saturday at 10:30 for Catskill Character on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.